We used to go fishing trips together a lot.
Guy Fage.
One year, and I believe it was 1969, and Dad's very, very animated and excited about this concept he had that they needed something that would be reusable, you know, so they could send in orbit, and rather than it, you know, coming back to Earth in a parachute, they would glide it back into Earth, you know, like an airplane. It's kind of a one-sided conversation. He was going on and on about it, but it was exciting to listen to.
Let's return for a moment to Guy Fage's family home and the place where many of his father's ideas first took flight.
He would take it out in the backyard and test glide it. And that was kind of fun to watch him. A lot of times I would go pick it up and bring it back to him. And it would glide, he'd throw maybe 10 or 15 feet before it settled in the grass.
It started off primarily as something that's a lot smaller than the Proton shuttle, having wings and landing gear.
You know, he was already moving on from the Apollo program, which put men on the moon, for crying out loud. You know, that was a big deal. And he was already, you know, moving on to this phase of his career. To me, that just shows, you know, how innovative he was.
We formed a small group of people here at the Johnson Space Center with the idea of looking into the feasibility of a completely reusable two-stage vehicle.
Max Fage called it the Skunk Works.
Tom Moser, the former director of engineering at Johnson Space Center. Fage's Skunk Works was a prolific ideas factory, and the designs came thick and fast.
You know, they were looking at, you know, a configuration a day almost. And he had an aerodynamicist and a structures guy and a propulsion guy and a cost guy over cranking some numbers. But they would come up with a concept and we'd have to help them determine, okay, what the cost of that vehicle would be.
The result was like a Cambrian explosion of spaceship designs. Some weird, some wonderful, most deeply impractical. Jennifer Lavasseur is the shuttle curator at the National Air and Space Museum in Washington, D.C.
There are some really wonderful models in the collection of the National Air and Space Museum, even, that are from the designs of Grumman Aerospace and Lockheed Martin. And all of the big companies that are involved in Apollo are also, once again, kind of putting in their design concepts for shuttle. And there are lots of different configurations. There are considerations about being reusable, what types of rockets, how many orbiters even. There are some that look like they actually have two orbiters stuck together. There's one even called a Triamese that has what looks like two shuttles and then a big tank in the middle of it.
Many of these strange spacecraft ideas look like they've been ripped from the pages of a science fiction comic book. They're exciting, audacious, and dripping with potential, but in the end, it was affordability and not astrodynamics that clipped their wings. What NASA could build came down to what their customers wanted and were willing to pay for.
So lots of really creative ideas, but when you're whittling down your ability to pay for something and develop something that is brand new, comes down to who's your customer. And in this case, one of the major customers for NASA is going to be the U.S. military. And in the case of the shuttle orbiter, the determining factor really is what's the size, shape, and weight of a thing that the Department of Defense would want to put into orbit.
Max Fage's team had imagined a small shuttle that could be carried to the edge of space riding on the back of a huge piloted flyback booster. But the Air Force had other ideas.
The Air Force got in on a shuttle program early and demanded a very large vehicle that would carry a lot of weight, 60,000 pounds, into orbit. And that 60,000 pounds was dictated by the Air Force, who said they wouldn't support the funding unless we met some of their requirements. Well, they'd say bend, and we'd say, well, how far we got to bend?
And as it turns out, there would be lots of bending. Let's start with the size and weight of the payload that the U.S. Air Force wanted shuttle to carry. Of course, the Air Force had a very specific cargo in mind.
The military told NASA, first of all, we want a 60-foot long payload bay. And, you know, we can't go into the details of why they might have wanted that, but obviously there were some things they wanted to launch that were 60 feet long.
Even 50 years on, former astronaut Jeff Hoffman is not alone in being surprisingly evasive about the nature of that payload. I tried again when we spoke with Bob Crippen, pilot of STS-1, the first space shuttle mission to launch into orbit around the Earth.
And early on, we flew some significant Department of Defense missions that I personally believe helped us win the Cold War. They're all classified, so we can't talk about them, but it was important.
So I had one last go with Apollo 13 veteran Fred Hayes. And you talk there about the requirement from the US Air Force to be able to retrieve a payload in a single orbit and to deploy a payload. What payload specifically requires that?
I have no idea.
Old secrets die hard. We'll hear a lot more from Fred and his adventures wrestling the prototype space shuttle out of the skies above Edwards Air Force Base in the next episode. But the nature of this supposedly mysterious payload requirement has since been declassified, and historian Matthew Hirsch was able to shed some light.
The historical record indicates a flurry of memoranda and letters between the Secretary of the Air Force and his staff and NASA regarding the configuration of the vehicle. The size, the 15 by 60 cargo bay that the shuttle will eventually have, was designed specifically for reconnaissance satellites. And we know this because they discussed this somewhat arbitrary requirement, and that's what the Air Force called it, in the negotiations with NASA.
And Ken Young, who was responsible for mission planning in the early days of the shuttle program, finally found himself able to tell me without later having to shoot me.
Well, I can now tell you, I guess. We put out in the early 70s, or started working on them, 72, 73, four design reference missions, two of which were classified. It's called Mission 3A and 3B. And it was secret, but of course just a few of us were cleared for secret. They wanted to be able to take the shuttle out of Vandenberg, fly it one time around, open the payload doors, pick up or deploy a friendly or unfriendly spy satellite, put it in the bay, close the doors, and come back and land in California in one rev. And so two of the missions were that, one just to deploy and the other to actually pick up, open the payload doors, grapple a friendly or unfriendly satellite, put it in the bay, close the doors, and re-enter in an hour and 40 minutes.
And why did they want to do that in a single orbit?
You know, security reasons and to be able to tell the Russians we had nothing to do with it until, you know, X revs later. It was pretty damn ridiculous.
Ken Young. Here's military astronaut Bob Stewart, the first active duty Army officer to go into space, explaining how NASA's shuttle got saddled with a payload bay large enough to take a 16-wheel articulated truck into space.
All politics. You see, NASA had this idea of a very small space shuttle. As a matter of fact, it had straight wings. Didn't look anything like the shuttle that we ended up with. But in order to fund that program, we had to get Air Force support. And if the Air Force said we're going to use the shuttle, then you have to make the shuttle big enough to handle any payload that we want to take. So that meant that the shuttle started growing.
A larger payload bay meant a larger and heavier vehicle with a massive secret payload on board. And that in turn created a new problem. How to lift all of that mass into space? Jeff Hoffman.
They didn't have enough thrust basically to get the whole system off the ground. And so they needed the extra boosters, which could have been liquid boosters. The advantage of a liquid booster is that you can shut it down if something goes wrong. But the boosters They also wanted to recover them and reuse them. And a liquid engine falling into the ocean, getting soaked in seawater, a bit problematic, plus more expensive to develop. So in the end, NASA went with solids.
What Jeff's talking about here is NASA's infamous decision to use solid rocket boosters in the design of Space Shuttle. Picture the stack on the launch pad, with the orbiter mounted on the side of its giant external tank, flanked on each side by two white, pencil-like rockets. These are the solid rocket boosters, so called because they're filled with a dense, solid cake of highly energetic fuel. This had never been done before. Solids had never been used on human-rated vehicles. And for good reason.
Solid rocket boosters are a technology that have been used at this point for lots of unpiloted space probes and other vehicles, but they've never been used on a rocket that carries human beings, for some obvious reasons. They're gigantic firecrackers, which means once you ignite them, you can't turn them off. You also can't throttle them, which is a big problem if you're trying to put yourself into a precise orbit. And as a result, they're used for things that are basically expendable or disposable.
The need to carry a heavy military payload forces a shift in the vehicle's design, away from Max Faget's vision of an elegant and entirely reusable space plane. This single requirement transforms the architecture into something less graceful, more brutal, and ultimately more dangerous.
The idea of using solid rocket boosters is controversial, and there's a lot of debate about whether this is even safe to use on a human-piloted vehicle. At the time, the Air Force rejects this as being profoundly and manifestly unsafe. NASA proceeds anyway, in part because it has no other option.
The solid rocket boosters alone were not enough. Shuttle would also incorporate three powerful liquid-fueled main engines mounted inside the vehicle at the rear of the orbiter. But with so much space taken up by the large payload bay came the problem of where to store the propellant.
You couldn't put all that propellant on board the shuttle vehicle, and that led to the idea of, well, let's have an external fuel tank. The external tank was not going to be reused. That's the one part of the system that was sacrificed, so the main engines had to be attached to the shuttle. So we have the two solid boosters on the sides of the external fuel tank, and the shuttle basically... The shuttle was a payload, and payloads are supposed to go on top of the stack. But the shuttle was too big to sit on top of the external tank. I mean, some of the earlier configurations when they were looking at smaller shuttles did sit on top. But the big shuttle, just aerodynamically, it would have been totally unstable. And so it had to sit on the side. And that's how the shuttle came to be what it looks like today.
There's one last major feature of the Space Shuttle's design that we haven't fully explained: the size and shape of its wings. Shuttle featured large delta wings, triangular in appearance and swept back towards the rear of the spacecraft with the same total surface area as a tennis court. The question is why? And the answer is that Shuttle had to do more than skim back through the atmosphere like a rock skipping over water, the way the Apollo command modules had. Shuttle had to be able to turn and maneuver to move vast distances across the sky to get back to its point of origin. And this ability to behave somewhat like a plane whilst travelling at hypersonic velocities more than five times the speed of sound was called cross-range.
What idiot aeronautical engineer would make a wing that big, but I needed that really big wing to achieve the cross range? Because as we are in flight around the Earth, we are fixed in inertial space. So as a matter of fact, I am flying in a fixed inertial pattern while the Earth rotates under me.
What Bob Stewart is describing here is a unique property of Shuttle. When you're in orbit around the Earth, you're on a fixed path with the world turning underneath you. If you're in a capsule, where you land is determined by how and where you re-enter the atmosphere. The Apollo capsules had very little capability to alter their path during re-entry. But for Shuttle, hoping to engage in high-speed espionage, launching into space, deploying a spy satellite, and then landing in the United States on a specific runway, and all in a single orbit, this wasn't good enough.